Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm here with my co-host and friend, Anthony McCarthy, my colleague who has his own show every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. This time slot right here on WEAA 88.9 FM. Fridays 5 to 7 p.m. joins us here every Monday from 5 to 7 p.m. on the Mark Steiner Show. Becomes the Mark and Anthony Show.
I enjoy it.
I do
really
too.
I really do, Mark.
410-319-8888. Before Anthony and I kind of shift gears a little bit here, so we want to talk some other things that have happened in the news, but let me get your thoughts here. Let's see who's been around for a while waiting. John, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Welcome.
Once again, another great episode of the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm the guy that tries to put the big picture together in 30 seconds. Can't do it. You guys have pretty much covered everything I was thinking of while I was waiting. But the way, like the health care bill,
mm-hmm.
$1 trillion beyond my imagination.
Yep.
Wars, two of them, where we're paying premium prices to have contractors, like somebody in the earlier half of the show said. You know, we used to be a great team, a huge, well-oiled machine, a great team that would do it. The Army, you know, the Navy. Now it's contractors. Massive amounts of money going to that, billions. And then you combine that with the legislation and unionization of the workforce and policies that go on in the counties and all that we've been, you know, in the city we've been talking about in the past.
Mm-hmm.
It just has us so entrenched in the status quo that doesn't enable it, so we're so immobilized.
Mm.
And all this getting together and speaking, and we're really going to have to, like, get rid of all these things, all these rules and laws and all that that enable people to just do so much and not produce. And am I making any sense with this?
Yes. You are making sense with
I don't want to hold you on the phone because you know, forever, but because there's so much that goes into this, and I can't get into all the details, but social change on a massive scale, like I said a few weeks ago. On a different subject.
Well, we need social change at a macro scale in America. And I think that we have to have a question of how we're going to get there. And I think that's part of the... I was with some friends the other night who were talking about the single payer. We actually had a fundraiser for the Mark Steiner Show in our companies. We could keep doing these shows. And there were a number of single payer advocates there. And we were talking and I said, you know, part of the problem with what's going on, let's say with single payer, where people aren't connecting to it, is because the corporations in America have their machine out there kind of trashing public option and trying to keep their profits alive over, I think, the health care of American people, which means they probably will not become my underwriters, but that's just life. but the other part of that is I said to them, you've got to make the medicine simple. You got to say something like, what single payer does, a public option does, it just gives you the freedom of choice to pick your physician, pick your hospital, work with your doctor and nobody else. It's not government intervention. And then we can go about doing real health care reform to control the cost in America. But until you get everyone insured and everybody taken care of, we're never going to control the rest of the cost of health care.
And we're so driven, Mark, by these messages. And we shout each other down instead of having a reasonable conversation. Because, if we're being honest, we want companies to be profitable. But we don't want people to lie and misinform the public at the cost of profit. And oftentimes when I've watched, and my friends are like, why are you watching these town hall meetings? Mark, I watch them because I find it fascinating that individuals can stand up and not have a reasonable conversation or even a debate about the issue that they're there to have. It really is about, I'm going to yell much louder than you are, or I'm going to make some rhetorical system about taking America back. Instead of having an honest conversation about what does it mean to insure all Americans, and if that's our goal, because that's what the major healthcare companies will tell you, that is their goal as well. But how do we get there? And is there a way that we can do this that best serves the least among us, the Americans who've fallen through that safety net, but who are in dire need of services? And I know what I'm talking about. As someone who has lupus, who has to figure out ways to get prescriptions filled and most of the time go without prescriptions at the cost of my own health because I don't have health insurance. And so, you know, I get frustrated by the misinformation because you and I work very hard to be objective. But oftentimes it's hard to be objective when you see that people are really just lying.
Yes.
Yeah.
And people suffer. I mean, and you're suffer. A person that shows the example of all of you out there. 410-319-8888 is the number here to talk about this. A solid job in the middle class, job fell out for all the wrong reasons, and you lost health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane. That is absolutely insane. 410-319-8888. Michael Scott, you're on the air.
Mark and Anthony, how you guys doing?
Michael Scott, I haven't heard your voice in a long time. Good
a
to hear
long
you.
Time.
It's been a minute. It's been. I'm in the trenches, in the policy trenches, and I think you guys have hit it in that last commentary. It's really, this is a question of equity, right? And, you know, and all the screaming you hear is, you know, really the Willie Hortonization of Barack Obama. This is not about all the things that they're saying. It's about something else. And because if, you know, if you really look at the economics, I mean, we're not really talking about socialism. I mean, people that are using big words need to look them up, especially the Limbaughs of the world. It's so far removed.
Say again, Michael, we just lost you. Your cell phone's breaking up.
Oh, sorry about that. I said folks that are screaming, the pundits that are stoking the fires, the Rush Limbaughs of the world, need to look up the word socialism. They don't know what they're talking about. It's so far removed from that, but it's really a hot button issue to galvanize politics around. A certain coarseness and incivility that the country's moved toward, and I think this week with Teddy Kennedy's funeral, you know, we kind of saw unfortunately a passing of an era of what America used to be about in terms of civil discourse and debate, and we've moved away from that. And so you've got a bunch of dummies talking about stuff they don't know about, riling up other folks, and we're getting away from the real hearts of the matter, which is just a conversation about equity. This is a conversation, you know, it's not so much about health care. It's why are people getting sick in the first place, given the amount of money we spend? I mean, there are different kinds of qualitative questions that need to be answered, but they need a higher mindedness of civility that we certainly don't have at the moment.
I think you're right. I think, and the question is, who controls the heights of the public conversation is the problem, because it's always being hijacked. Just like the healthcare town meetings were hijacked. They were hijacked by people who fueled it, who had a lot of money to create ads to go attack it. They were hijacked by minority groups like Lyndon LaRouche's crazy people. And I guess it's not objective, but they are. I mean, I've known those folks since the 60s, that they're just, people think they're on the left. They're not on the left. They're just, they're from, they're like maybe, I don't know, Uranus, Mars, Saturn somewhere, but
I would probably stop now.
Okay, I'll stop. Thanks, Anthony.
Yes, sir.
But it is. I mean, that's right. The conversation has been hijacked, and I think that, but part of that, I lay at the doorstep of Barack Obama and the White House for not making the argument on health care the way they should and leaving it up to Congress. I think that was a serious strategic flaw.
And Mark, this president, and I know people are going to be very upset when they hear me say this president has proven himself to be able to galvanize, a lot like Ronald Reagan, galvanize the American people by speaking truth to power. And he has set back, and I'm not sure, Mark, and what it made me do was start digging. Who's giving Barack Obama, President Obama, money? Where are these contributions coming from? Because I didn't understand, when you make a promise to move the healthcare debate forward and bring us healthcare reform, but you put it in the hands of Congress and then you step away, as opposed to using that great pulpit and that power that he has to move us as a nation, that he's proven that he could move us and he could move us past all this rhetorical madness and incivility. But for some reason, this president and his spokesperson and his administration has gone up to the edge and they've stopped. And I think we're going to see some change. I watched the president during the Kennedy funeral, and I think he walked a fine line about pushing this argument about redefining and managing this health care debate. But something's got to happen. There has to be a game changer from the White House, Mark, because Barack Obama, President Obama, and his administration have lost the driver's seat in this conversation.
Mm-hmm. I think they have. And I think what Michael Scott, you were mm-hmm. raising about the argument about socialism is right. I think we do have to discuss what all that means in America. And I think that we don't really understand what that word means. And we also understand what rethink what our society needs to look like. I mean, a single-payer healthcare system would fuel the entrepreneurial spirit in medicine, not dampen it, if it's done the right way. It's just a pass-through system to pay the bills, and we can deal with the rest later.
Let's get people insured. Let's get people insured and allow them to take control of their health.
410-319-8888 is the number here. And let's go back to the phones. And who is waiting online for us is Michael. You're on the air. Another Michael. This is a day for Michaels. Michael, you're there.
That's okay. It seems like it is.
Hey, good. Welcome.
Mark Stein, McCartney, Mike Johnson, how are you?
Hey, Michael.
You know, it's interesting. A couple callers ago when the gentleman called in reference to, I don't know, dogging the city workers or whatever the case is. I mean, one of the things we have to be really, really clear, and this wasn't an issue until rich people started losing money. I mean, everything was fine as long as, you know, low-income people who pay all of the same taxes, even if it's not the personal income tax, you know, they still pay the payroll tax to support the Social Security and Medicare. They still pay sales taxes through their rents and gasoline taxes. I mean, it's amazing to me, and I think the young lady had called and said how poor people, and she used a racial tone, but I think poor white people, poor Latinos, and poor African Americans are really catching hell on this thing because, you know, when government changes the licensing and they raise the license, it's a 1-2 punch against low-income people because, you know, a lot of the licenses are for the services provided. I don't know when the last time you went to get a driver's license. And today is my birthday. My license
Happy
expired.
Birthday.
Thank you. My license expired today. Mark, you know if I'm 54 or old, you are my brother. But
what was that?
But, you know, at the end of the day, we sit around and we don't talk about what government, it was okay for the longest of time that poor people were catching the hell of the tariffs and the quotas and all of the necessary things that we were paying for shoes and clothing and food and everything. But now that the wealthy producers are catching heck around here, you know, a lot of the folk that are working in the nonprofit venue or working in the venue of the communities, you know, we're catching it less. We're catching it more because now people now folk aren't even donating to the institutions that could even help poor people. So that means on the back end, you know, we're catching hell all the way across the line. So it's just always amazing to me. When the economy started screwing up, it was poor people and black people who was responsible for the housing shortage. Well, now that the economy is going to south, you know, some people can call up and say, well, people should think they hit the lottery because they got the state jobs. Well, that may be the people who are on the high end. But the people who are working and daily going to work every day, they're catching it just like everyone else. Because just like, and I'll make it short because I know you guys want to move on. But just like Anthony was saying earlier about someone going to the market. I mean, I went to the market today, and I bought 4 bags of groceries. It cost me $92. And after I put it in my refrigerator, I'm trying to figure out what I bought.
Right. I mean, you have to. I hear you. I know that's exactly true. I mean, I think that this is people who are of moderate income or low income in America, which is almost most Americans, are really feeling this pinch, which is why restaurants are closing, which is why every retail outlet you see has a different sale every day, trying to attract people into their stores. We are, you know, as Bob Herbert wrote, he wrote this in May.
Wow.
7.8 million jobs are gone and we have to replace them. This is a very serious crisis for this country and what we're facing. And I think we're not the people we had on last week in the show who their programs are closing right and left from the community perspective, working in poor communities. I mean, all this is very real and we have to get our hands around it very quickly. The only way that's done is that people form their own kind of political network to insist on some change happening. You know, I think that's a big piece of it. And Michael, thank you for that call. And it's always good to hear your voice as well. Anthony, folks, join us here with your thoughts on all this at 410-319-8888. Anthony and I have been talking about a bunch of things this hour and didn't want to and want to kind of talk about a few other things. I want to let you know that tomorrow on Democracy Now! On Friday, which airs in the station 8 o'clock every morning, Monday through Friday, you heard from Elizabeth Jacobson, who is a Wells Fargo subprime loan officer who said that her job was to help figure out how to go to black churches and get people to take subprime mortgages, even if they didn't want them. She's going to join us tomorrow to talk about what her role is and what was going on with Wells Fargo and what that meant for our society. I'll let you know that's coming up to talk about. And today I was reading the news just now, Anthony. I meant to put that little computer in front of you so you have a computer too. I apologize. But there was an article in one of the New York Times, or Huffington Post today, said that conservative pundit George Will, has just called for the United States ground troops to leave Afghanistan. George will. So there's a whole anti-war movement brewing again around Afghanistan, which is kind of pretty amazing. A lot of things are going on.
Country that just had elections and still trying to work out the results of that election, and it looks like Karzai, President Karzai, is ahead. It really is a tough. I'm looking forward to that show, Mark.
And we're also we have a show on Afghanistan on Thursday. Mm-hmm. Debate about Afghanistan, the future of Afghanistan, is coming on Thursday, and then sometime in the next week or so, when Kayum Karzai, who's Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan's brother, is back in Baltimore, he's going to come on to tell us what's going on from his perspective. So we'll be hearing from folks live on the ground as well. But so join us here at 410-319-8888. But Anthony, we had some other issues that you were.
I just wanted to put on the table, and you and I were talking about it when you graciously was driving me to the studio today. We were talking about this healthcare debate and Senator Kennedy's passing or his death, and would it change the tone of this debate? And really, if you listen to our callers, your callers, a lot of the callers have said that the conversation has become so coarse and so partisan that there isn't a lot of wiggle room to bring compromise, and that Senator Kennedy was the great line of the Senate who could reach across those party lines and bring these coalitions together. And Bill Bradley wrote in the New York Times this weekend something very interesting. He said, look, if health care reform is going to really take hold and the Congress is going to move forward, then both sides have to give. And that right now he doesn't believe that this Congress is in the mood for compromise, but that the Democrats should offer the Republicans things like tort reform, put it right in the legislation, something that would appease Republicans, where Republicans could go home into their conservative, oftentimes conservative constituencies, and say, look, we forced their hand on this, and we were able to come to the table. He also said, like the president, Mark, is saying, the public option is important, but don't let the debate on the public option, and I'm beginning to hear a lot of Democratic senators say this, Mark, don't let the debate on the public option sink getting legislation out of Congress.
Well, this becomes really interesting. I mean, because you talked about Senator Kennedy passing, and the idea now is that Deval Patrick is saying that he's backing an election to Senator Kennedy's replacement for January 19th that just came out this afternoon in the news before he went on the air. And it's becoming more and more likely, as we've talked, that Vicky Kennedy, the widow of Senator Ted Kennedy, is going to be the interim senator from Massachusetts. And my guess is she'll probably run for office. It's my guess. Just a guess. Because she's a very sharp woman, her own right. So, but at any rate, that would give the Democrats
a rallying point.
You were talking about they might change the name to the Kennedy Bill to memorialize it for him, and also gives a psychological move. And if the Democrats have, what is that then, 59, 60 votes?
60.
They have 60 plus one or two Republicans, and the Democrats control the House. So some people are arguing, well, if we really want a health care reform, why are you let's get it done and then fight
and you
battles.
Have the votes to get it done. Right. And you have the votes to get it done. And Mark, I was listening in my office today to some of these pundits talking, and these left-leaning, more liberal pundits, and they're making that argument. You know what? Instead of us getting stuck on this idea of compromising, let's not compromise. Let's ensure Americans, and let the chips fall where they may, but let's force the other side to come to the table, because guess what? We gave the Democrats control.
Right.
And so we gave them control. But, Mark, this speaks to a much bigger issue. I wonder where all the Democrats in Congress are on this issue. I mean, when you hear people talking about the people who campaigned on single payer, throwing single payer out the window, people who campaigned and said a public option is a must in any health care reform legislation, now saying, let's not let it sink the legislation. It makes you wonder where the Democratic leadership and where the Democrats in Congress are on health care reform.
Somebody I haven't had in the air for a long time, Jay Hancock, wrote in The Sun today that how dire things are for the state of Maryland. We were talking about a little earlier. They say state spending declined for the second year in a row. to under $14 billion. O'Malley will cut more than $4 billion in spending since he took office. $4 billion. And he's cut more than 2,000 positions from state government, but there weren't any layoffs. And there now might still be layoffs. I mean, this is, we're facing a very tough time. So we want to see what you think. 410-319-8888. What you think about where health care should go in America, where that, as Anthony and I were talking about where that debate is going to go with the Senator Kennedy passing and perhaps his wife picking up the torch in the U.S. Senate. 410-319-8888. Then we're going to take a little detour when we come back from this break and talk about something that not on the radar screen because it's in the front page of the local paper, The Sun, but maybe a little twist on where this might be going and where the politics and how it's changed so much in America. 410-319-8888. I'm here with Anthony McCarthy. I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of, is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News and World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and I'm here with my co-host and friend, Anthony McCarthy, my colleague who has his own show every Friday from 5 to 7 p.m. This time slot right here on WEAA 88.9 FM. Fridays 5 to 7 p.m. joins us here every Monday from 5 to 7 p.m. on the Mark Steiner Show. Becomes the Mark and Anthony Show.
I enjoy it.
I do,
really
too.
I really do, Mark.
410-319-8888. Let's go back to the phones, Anthony, right away. And someone wants to comment on your Ted Kennedy thing that you brought up, and Dolores, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Dolores, you're on the air.
Yes.
Hi.
Okay, I just found it interesting, particularly when I was watching the funeral, that Ted Kennedy's family had selected Mark, Matthew 25, okay? And, of course, that was completely in line with, well, then you could see how all of the work that he's done in Congress was aligned with the teachings of Christ. Now, I know when you're talking politics, religion and all of that is a bad word. But here was a man whose political career was obviously, in teaching with what he believed, with his faith. And most of those people in that audience, those senators and congressmen and all of them people, most of them are Christians, whether they're Catholics or not. And I was just wondering if anybody's moral soul had been touched by that. Because here was a rich man who had dedicated his life to helping other people.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize he had done so much and so many varied things. But everything they mentioned was in line with that. And I'm saying if these people sitting there, some of these people sitting there, don't have any heart at all. I mean, if they have any heart at all, they have to be moved by that. And their conscience, I hope, they would get back and try to peacefully work out something that would actually help people.
I found it fascinating. I watched the entire hour and 45 minutes of the funeral for Ted Kennedy on Saturday in Boston. And as she mentioned, there was a great deal of mentioning of the senator's belief that to whom much is given, much is required, and that we have an obligation, especially when you are blessed, but even if you are struggling, that we have an obligation, Mark, as people of faith, to help the least among us, those who struggle the most, those who are going without right now. And there was a great deal of remembrance of that during that service for Senator Kennedy, that he comes from a wealthy family. And I would dare say, Mark, that 99.9% of the people in that room, and it was filled to capacity, were wealthy people.
Yes, American politics is full of wealthy people.
Wealthy people. I mean, it was the elected class of our society was there to pay tribute to one of their colleagues. But I think that his life, if we could say anything, a lot of politicians would tell you that if they were able to accomplish two or three great things where it impacts people, whether it's scholarships or healthcare or civil rights, that they really spent their time well. Mark, his Senator Ted Kennedy's name is associated with more than 500 landmark pieces of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a great deal of it has to do with longevity. He was there a long time. And there was and his son, Teddy Jr., said this, his father was seeking redemption. He felt in many ways that he had made some mistakes in his life and that if he wasn't going to the White House, guess what? He was going to work in the Senate to make the world a better place for his own personal soul. And I found it fascinating. Mark, this is going to sound so harsh, and I don't mean to direct at any particular politician. But when people like Senator Edward Kennedy die and you see what they have spent their life doing – as a political junkie and a political observer, it really shows the shortcomings of so many people that we put in public office and how time is just whittling away. And I wonder if we were to ask some of these people who represent our city, who represent our state, what is your legacy going to be? What piece of how significant are you changing the landscape of this country? I think they would come up wanting. And I know I would come up wanting, and most of us would come up wanting. But I think I hope that, as the caller said, I hope it drives us to a different place, an urgency to get things done and do it right for people.
Well, and I think there is that kind of urgency, and I hope people can find it. I think we're in that situation, America, where it calls for that kind of urgency. I mean, I think that we are in I think we're in a very precarious position in America, and it can go and teeter-totter any way at this moment. And people like Ted Kennedy can be an inspiration. I mean, his children are and nephews and nieces are also, a lot of them are people who kind of are pushing the envelope very far, demanding change now. I say that Vicky Kennedy herself may even be more strident than her husband in terms of demanding change, which would be interesting to see. And I think that, you know, I'm just curious what our listeners would like to see in that vein. I don't know. Should we switch gears to this other subject we want to talk about now? Should we save it for another day? What do you want to do, Anthony?
Well, I don't know. I find that conversation that we want to have about the casinos that are going to I guess they're planned for the city,
right?
Maybe
you had the article in front of you.
I do. Mm-hmm. And there is an investor from Canada that has assembled a local team led by Michael Cryer, who is well-known for his political connections, his PR savvy. He is a close confidant of Governor Martin O'Malley. He came in during a very difficult time when Martin O'Malley was having some trouble around homicides and violence and crime in the city, and people were frustrated by this zero tolerance, and he crafted a message of believe in your city, get treatment for drug addiction, get a job, get help if you need help. And for all the criticism of the Believe campaign, people rallied around it, and the corporate community rallied around it, and the philanthropic community rallied around it. Well, Michael Cryer went on to become the head of the state Democratic Party. He's a very powerful consultant in this state, and now he's leading he's the leading spokesperson for this collection of individuals who will be in charge of, if everything goes as now planned, the casino that is built, the gaming casino slots in the city of Baltimore. You and I were talking, and a lot of this is a benefit of, I guess, us having friends and connections in a lot of different places. But there is a certain Michael Cryer himself taught me one time that there is an achievement class in Baltimore, an achievement class that has been able to walk in both worlds. And by that, I mean they grew up in predominantly black neighborhoods and communities. They went to integrated schools, made friends with and became lifelong friends with people of different races. And they've been able to, Mark, build those relationships into very successful careers. And there is a group of, you know, people, I'm not sure if it's good to say names, but people should know that Michael Cryer is very close to this mayor, but very close to a lot of the African-American power structure, the faith community in this city. Brian Marsh, the former head of the school system, got himself in a...
Chairman of the board.
Yeah, chairman of the school system, board of commissioners. Very connected politically, but also very well known in the African-American leadership community, the faith community. Many times the reforms in the school, I think, were tempered because of Brian Morris's relationships. But he had a very strong business connection to Martin O'Malley. And, you know, Mark, you said something to me before we went on the air. I was talking about all these successful business people. But there is a social component also of folks who went to public schools and grew up here in this city, built these networks, like Joe Jones and his Center for Urban Families. I forget the Farouk, brother.
We talked about the passing of Leon Farouk. Ex-con who could walk in both worlds.
And was very comfortable with millionaire philanthropic leaders, but also very comfortable spending the night, Leon Farouk, on the streets in East Baltimore. And would tell you about his life in prison. And so there is this very interesting connection that probably could go for a whole show. Of these leaders and where they come from and the connections that they have.
The question is, when people look at people like Mike Cryer, and I would say I've known Mike Cryer for a long time, and we're friends, and I've known him since we were 14, 15 years old, before anybody was famous, and he was just a baseball player at Baltimore City College that all the girls wanted to go out with. So that's why I never liked him. But I'm just kidding. But from that period, I mean, it's interesting. The question is, the whole idea of integration in America not really working. But for a group of people in certain communities in Baltimore that had an interracial past because of the time when Baltimore schools were integrated, have kept those relationships up over 20, 30, 40 years, depending on how old you are, and that has lent itself to something. So the question is that somebody would argue, okay, well, is that kind of just giving up who you are, becoming white? Is it a question of becoming white, or mm-hmm. is it a question of really – understanding both sides of the fence and be able to walk into different worlds and get things done.
And there are going to be people who are going to argue, Mark, that it's not about race. It's about class. It's about your economic status in the community. These people are very wealthy. Michael Cryer is a wealthy person.
Now, he's doing okay.
Yes,
he might say, no, I'm not wealthy.
Say he's not wealthy. You're right. Right. But a Brian Morris does not come out of the blue. There are years and years of development and relationships.
He was a working class kid from the inner city who went to an integrated school that was top-notch academically when he was there at City and took full advantage of it.
And so I find it fascinating. I think it would make I'd be very interested to hear what other people think about – but, you know, Ron Lipscomb, the head of Doricon, who's been in the headlines, of course, because of his relationship with the mayor of the city. But these individuals, Michael Cryer, Brian Morris, Ron Lipscomb, these individuals didn't just appear out of the air. There were literally years and years of foundations built under them where they built networks in both worlds. And I hate to break it to folks, but there are two very distinct
You can't be successful in America if you live in your own narrow world. Now, you could if you're white for a long time because you own the planet. I'm saying, but
that's why they hate you, Mark Steiner.
But that's changing, mm-hmm. and that has changed, and that dynamic has changed. And it is more about class than race on some levels. And that what's changing, though, is that because white America soon will be the largest minority in America, but everyone's going to be a minority in this country, that power dynamic changes. So it's not going to be simple as to say, I have it all now, mm-hmm. and you have to share it. But it's the people, I think, who have been able to cross the cultural bridges of America, divides, and bridge those divides in America, are in the strongest position. And I think that you can do that without losing who you are. You don't have to be an Oreo or an apple. That's what they call it on the res.
I don't even know what that is.
Indians were like,
oh, okay.
You know, red on the outside, white on the inside. And so, but you don't, I learned so much from you. You don't have to be, you know. And so what do you think? This is just a little sidebar that we got into driving over here to the station there. We were thinking about.
Mark, when I worked at the White House before, during Bill Clinton's first term, and I worked with Dede Meyers and had the pleasure, I never really, but anyway, long story short, I saw people like Vernon Jordan and others who came through that power structure who are now corporate leaders. But cut their teeth in the civil rights movement. And I think about people like a Vernon Jordan, who's now this powerful lobbyist and attorney.
Yeah.
And he learned how to not manipulate the system, but become part of.
But you only have to be a corporate leader. I mean, it's just like Leon Fruco is not a corporate leader.
Very good point.
Joe Jones isn't really a corporate leader, though. He knows how to walk both sides of those streets. Former addict who now runs an incredible program. Representative John Lewis from Atlanta. Is still Representative John Lewis from Atlanta, who got his head busted in.
That's right.
In the SNCC.
And a Julian Bond, the exact same thing.
But right. they maneuver the world. So what do you think about what we're talking about here? Is this just ridiculous? 410-319-8888.
These are the things that Mark Steiner and I think of.
And let us know that we're not just alone out here and we're just talking to each other. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page, Mark Steiner, and put your comments there as well. Corrigan. In Pikesville, you're on the air.
Hey.
Hi, Corrigan.
How are you this evening?
Well, welcome.
I think your friend knows me well.
I do.
And Mark, actually, we've met. I'm Dr. Vaughn's son.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Reverend A.C. Vaughn.
What I wanted to piggyback on what you were saying is I'll give you a perfect example. I'm the godson of the late Dr. Ralph David Abernathy. Grew up in Baltimore, went to Baltimore Public City Schools, graduated from Northwestern Senior High School, getting ready to graduate with another degree from the University of Virginia.
Okay.
Congratulations.
At Lynchburg. Thank you. But the interesting thing, on this day, and I guess you guys don't even remember this, but this is actually the anniversary of Katrina. Mm. And during that time, Anthony will tell you, I left here and set up a network down in the Gulf region, and every year we're going back helping those people. Well, not every year we're going back. We constantly do that, and it didn't have to do with the nationality or the ethnicity. It dealt with friendships that I developed over the long years. And one of the things that interests me a lot, especially here in the Baltimore metropolitan area, is that you have an interesting dichotomy of individuals who think that they are the movers and shakers.
Uh-huh.
And in actuality, some of the conversations in terms of what's going on in the city and in the state are actually the decisions are made in places like Pikesville Hilton, in the hotels and whatnot, before it even comes local news.
Right. So how does that relate to what we were talking about a minute ago?
Well, when you were talking about a minute ago, you were talking about Cryer being like, for instance, from City College and how he has basically used his relationships through the years to bring him where he is in terms of making his niche in terms of local government and state government. What I was agreeing with you is the biggest issue that I think that most of I wouldn't dare say the state and a lot of us don't understand that it really ethnicity doesn't matter as much as the relationships that you make in terms of helping other people.
All right, Corrigan, thank you. I think it does work both ways. I mean,
almost
race
definitely.
Is still a powerful issue in this country, and that's not gone away. But I'm saying that people who have been able to cross the divide on any number of levels, from any direction, have more power influence over what goes on, and that it's kind of a lesson for us. Whether you like the slots thing or not, I mean, there's a whole other question about. Slots Emporiums being in downtown Baltimore and
what that means.
Sucking the money out from working class people. And
it's a whole conversation that can take place.
So what do you think? 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Robert, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Robert.
This is Robert Burke. You know me, I'm sure. I've been on your show a long time ago.
Yes.
I think you've been talking about crossing divisions between members of the privileged classes. What we need to talk about is how to erode the divisions within the underprivileged classes.
Mm.
Now, August 28th passed with very little comment, and this was, of course, the 46th anniversary of the Great March on Washington. You've been asking about what can we do about the economic crisis. What we've got to do is organize a movement for economic justice, for social democracy, and that's what we got to do, and that's what Dr. King was talking about during the great, when he was preparing for the Poor People's Campaign. I would like to call upon people in this period of crisis to return to this idea of forming a powerful, popular, democratic movement for social justice to empower the underprivileged. King was talking about a possible economic bill of rights. We need to talk about that again. Why aren't we talking about this? Obama's not talking about it. No one seems to be talking about it. We need to get the churches, the trade unionists, community people, students, and others involved in a new movement. And I sort of am in sympathy with the comment of Michael Brand, who spoke some time before. I don't care what you call it either. Cooperative society, socialism. In fact, Dr. King himself indicated that perhaps we need to be thinking about some form of social democracy or democratic socialism anyway. So this is what we need to be talking about. As long as this comes down to a question of what negotiations are going to be made between Democrats and Republicans, the rest of us are going to get screwed. Well, it is the people who have to move. It's the common people who are always left out of this conversation when we're talking about people, whether it's Vernon Jordan, whoever, and what they can do, and that's all well and good. But they got health care. I'm a university professor. I have health care. Most of the people who grew up in the projects where I grew up, they don't have health care. Many of them don't have jobs. And so really, there is a point where I begin to tire a little bit of this conversation of negotiations that are going on between elites or what the achievement class is doing. All of that may be well and good. But as long as the common people, the masses of people are left out of this conversation, the conversation is going nowhere. I want to suggest we go back to the idea of the Bill of Rights.
Anthony was trying to make a comment.
Yeah, I would be very curious, Professor, we just heard a group of individuals earlier on the Mark Steiner Show talk about going to Washington so that the decision makers will hear them, because they, just like you, they believe that their voices have been shut out. They're not powerful lobbyists. They're not rich. But I'm very curious, when we use that kind of language about a social movement for change and bringing the voices of the poor to this debate, what does that look like? Because it appears to me that model, that call that you just made, that model doesn't work very effectively in the government that we have set up. Whether we're talking Washington, whether we're talking Annapolis or downtown Baltimore, that idea that there can be a movement, this so-called social movement, that is tangible, social movement to make change, I'm not sure what that looks like anymore. I do know what the formula of getting organized, getting elected, and becoming part of the decision-making class and sticking to your convictions and your conscience and being part of that dynamic and that conversation. I know what that looks like. That makes a little bit more sense to me than this idea that we have to, and maybe Mark understands better, because you were part of the civil rights movement and this movement for that really left an indelible mark on this country.
I think it's to figure out what to do in America right now is a tough thing to figure out.
It really is.
And I think what Robert was saying, at least I think what you were saying, Robert, was that part of it is that you, if people don't pull together and make a movement, if we call it a social movement, whatever, then things are not going to change. Because sometimes you can elect people to office, but then when the halls of power are just the corporate halls of power and not where the people are, then things don't change in any major way. And we'll see what happens with this healthcare reform. I mean, you know, if we look at, again, I go back to this quote that Barack Obama himself said during the election when he was asked, would Martin Luther King be backing
he sure did.
Him, or would he be backing Hillary Rodham Clinton for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States of America? And he said if Martin Luther King was alive, he wouldn't be backing either one of us. He'd be out there building a social movement to fight for change, independent of all of it. And that, I think that's part of what Robert's saying. What that means is, what form that takes, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I mean,
I understand his frustration. I mean, trust me, every day I feel his frustration and his pain and this sense of powerlessness, or decisions being made that impact us every day, and we have no power to push anything to the left or the right or straight forward. I understand that. I just believe that we have to somehow, Mark, employ a very different dynamic. The principle may be the same. The strategy has to be very different. I'm not sure if an independent political movement will ever work in this country.
That's interesting.
I mean, as much as I would love to, I voted for Greens here in the city. I voted for Greens in the state. And I would love to see that happen. I just don't see the legs or the drive to make that kind
but
of
But what he's
change.
Saying is, I wish we had more time for more callers to talk about this, but we're running close and out of time here. We think about this for another conversation we'll have on the air together. I mean, when I read the statistic that Bob Herbert put in his column in the New York Times, when he said that when we hit 10% unemployment in America, 50% of all black children in this country would live in poverty. Half of all the black children in the United States of America would be living under official poverty lines, which means it's larger. Think about
that. Which means it's larger.
So what people like Robert, I think, are saying is, something's got to be done about that, and building casinos downtown is not going to solve that. The other discussions that are being led to kind of boost somebody's business might not solve that in America. We've got to solve that issue. How can you let a country as rich as this have half of all black children in this country living in poverty? That's unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can change and turn around the schools, but you've got to change the economy so those kids who become educated have a job, or else you end up having a highly literate, unemployed class. That is volatile.
That's scary.
That is volatile. Anthony McCarthy, always good to have you here.
Always great to be with you. A lot to think about.
And we'll have a lot more to think about during the coming weeks together here, and we'll be talking about a lot tomorrow. And as I said, we'll be meeting Elizabeth Jacobson on the air tomorrow here, who is one of the people who worked for Wells Fargo, who is saying what that company did to undermine the economy, what her accusations are. She'll be joining us here with some others. You don't want to miss that. That should be a very interesting conversation, among others, we're going to have tomorrow for you and during the course of this week. Before I start all this off and remind you about who sponsors Mark Steiner's show and who produces, I want to say that I usually come off and say our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. Well, I won't be saying that anymore, because Jessica Phillips is leaving us today after 3.5 years. Is that right? 3.5 years. And Jessica came here when I first met her at breakfast in Hamden, introduced to us by somebody she was working with part-time. She had worked a little bit in public radio, but not very much, and worked for doing some editing, some other stuff for another public radio group in D.C. And I hired her as producer here on the Mark Steiner Show at that other station. And she blossomed into this incredible producer, who learned all the skills of editing. She went out to Vietnam to tape a series, which she just worked to finish putting all the elements together so we could finish producing that for our listeners here and around the country. We did Just Words together. It was funded by the Open Society Institute that won us a Peabody Award in 2007. It wouldn't have been done without her editing skills and all the work she put into it. And I think in many ways, as she said to me, her eyes were opened a lot from coming to work here and then going into the inner city and the poorest neighborhoods in our community to do these stories. And she was a very valuable member of our team who brought in all kinds of outside voices from her generation on this radio show. We're going to miss her a great deal, wish her a great deal of luck in her next pursuits. And we'll stay close to her on many levels. And we will miss you, Jessica Phillips. Thank you so much for helping make the Mark Steiner Show and reimagining it in your image. It was good to have you with us for all these years. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free monthly magazine of ideas. This month, Urbanite goes back to school with a learning issue featuring reports on the future of high-risk, high-stakes testing, new approaches to the dropout crisis, and challenges of teaching behind bars. Urbanite is available at over 750 locations. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're engineered today by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Floyd, Brian Boone, and Devin Finley. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.
It's summertime and we have some hot tunes to go with.